Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the shadows of the night. In the dead of night, when thy summer wounds shall not heal from the wind which howls about your being. In the dead of night, when your friends have gone and you sit huddled around the castle's fire. In the dead of night, when all is dark, who will you be tonight?
I am the dark and the night, a shadow in your dreams.
There is nothing wrong with your internet connection.
There is nothing wrong with your software.
This is the Night Zone, thinking outside the box.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, madam and messieurs. Welcome to
the Night Zone.
This is a live event.
There is nothing wrong with your computer. There is nothing wrong with your audio or your video. We are controlling the transmission for the next hour. And we will control all that you hear. Let me repeat. There is nothing wrong with your computer. You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to the shadows of the Night Zone with Colin Knight. The following program is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. Although the Night Zone takes all precautions to bring you quality information, the Night Zone and its subsidiaries or affiliates do not accept responsibility for information provided by our guests or hosts. The Night Zone is merely the purveyor of information. You, the audience, shall judge the quality of information offered by our guests or host. We remind all of our listeners, caveat emptor, your host, Colin Knight.
Tonight, we have a full agenda, a double guest night. Starting us off tonight in our 90-minute show is Richard Phillips, author of The Second Ship, a book from the series The Row Agenda. And the second half of our 90-minute show is Brent Cameron from PresidentialUFO.com, what the presidents knew about Roswell and other UFO cover-ups, all live in the Night Zone.
In the darkness of the Night Zone, we examine the works of Nostradamus through the eyes of John Hogue from HogueProphecy.com.
We shall look into the shadows of the Nostradamus prophecy of the Antichrist, decoded by John Hogue, codenamed
Mabus.
Nostradamus and the Antichrist, codenamed Mabus, with John Hogue.
I'm Colin Knight, your guide. John Hogue will be back with us in the fall. Until then, check the archives with John Hogue at HogueProphecy.com. Phone lines are open, 347-324-3287, 347-324-3287. You are in the Night Zone on BlogTalkRadio.com. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Colin Knight.
And good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another edition of the Night Zone. Ladies and gentlemen, madame and messieurs, mes enfants, it is a live edition. I am Colin Knight. Now, for some strange reason, our first guest hasn't been able to log in yet. So we are holding for Richard Phillips, the writer of The Second Ship, and we'll be back in just a few minutes.
Thank you.
And I do see a caller up online. Is this Richard? Is this Richard or Grant?
It's Grant.
Hello?
Grant.
Hey, Grant. Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. You saved my bacon. Good evening, sir.
There you go.
I had planned on bringing. I had planned on bringing you in on the second half of the show, Grant, but it does appear that Richard couldn't make it onto the show tonight. So I've got you, presidential UFOs. You got
there
my
you go.
Attention on. You got my attention on that. I'll tell you. How many presidents knew what and when? I mean, is this pervasive in the presidency?
Well, that's the big question is who knew what and when, and that gets kind of confusing. For almost any president, I can tell you three stories that show that they knew and three stories that show that they might not have known.
Right.
There seems to be no doubt that Truman knew what was going on, Eisenhower, and after that it gets a little foggy as to who knew what. One of the sort of basic things I think a lot of people agree on was that Bill Clinton was very interested in the phenomena, tried to figure out what was going on, and was not able to get any answers. So those kind of things we sort of know, and there's a number of rumored stories about Jimmy Carter on one hand knowing and then on the other hand not knowing. But there are some good stories about presidents being interested in trying to figure out what's going on.
Right. So let's head back to Eisenhower. And
okay.
What exactly was taking place that caused Eisenhower to be aware of UFOs?
Well, Eisenhower may have known even before he became president. He was commander of the Allied forces in Europe when Roswell took place. He was involved in a couple of meetings in and around Roswell with some of the key generals that were rumored to have been involved. So he may have known as early as back at the time of Roswell what was going on, that they had actually recovered something. When he gets into power, one of the problems with studying Eisenhower in terms of UFOs was that Eisenhower was very conscious of security. There's even stories told when he was the vice president, when he was being briefed as vice president. This was all very secretive, and they would take him across town, put him in through a building, take him out the back door down there just to go to an apartment to do the briefing, which now everybody knows where the briefing is. It's held in a secure vault type thing, but people know when the briefing is. But back in Eisenhower's day, for whatever reason, even his presidential briefings that happen when a president comes in, a president-elect is usually briefed by the CIA director from the foreign administration, and that's when they're basically told what the status of the country is and what kind of secrets and what kind of military operations are going on, this sort of stuff. So Eisenhower is very, very secretive, and there was some stories that sort of indicated that he may have known what was going on. For example, the famous MJ-12 papers, which were leaked back in the mid-1980s, which have come under a lot of question, and there's a number of other MJ-12-style documents that were released in the 1990s that were floated around, and all that seemed to center around, especially the first one, the MJ-12 documents, were purportedly a briefing that was given to President Eisenhower on the status of UFO information. Now, the one big story that happens in the Eisenhower administration, which I tracked, I went to the Eisenhower Library, and I believe that Bill Moore he was a very prominent researcher back in the 1980s. He spent a lot of time checking this story at the Eisenhower Library. That was the story about Eisenhower going to Edwards Air Force Base. This is in February of, I believe it was 1954. And there is no doubt he was on vacation at Palm Springs, California, and there's absolutely no doubt that he disappeared. In fact, the media was ready. One of the reporters from New York was ready to put on the wire that the president had a heart attack and had died, and the press secretary for the president actually stopped the story from going on, sort of gathered the reporters together and sort of crushed this story that the president had died. And the rumored story that started to appear in UFO material even a couple weeks after this incident by UFO groups in the 1950s was that Eisenhower had gone to Edwards Air Force Base. And the stories then vary as to what happened, whether he was shown dead alien bodies. But the story back in the 1950s was that he had met with aliens at right. Edwards Air Force Base.
Wow. Now there was there any presidential involvement prior to Roswell, or was Roswell kind of the kickoff point for the Blue Book and the likes?
No, I think sort of ufology has sort of missed a couple of stories. There is presidential documents that take place in, this would be February of 1942. This is the overflight of an object in Los Angeles, and this is where
right.
They open 1,400 rounds of ammunition, and I think there was actually about 7 people killed by this ammunition coming down. It was written up extensively for about a week and a half in the Los Angeles Times, and this was this object that had flown over, and there is actual presidential correspondence with General Marshall, who was Secretary of War at the time. And Marshall writes a letter to the president, or a memo, basically stating what had happened, that this object had come over and that they had shot at the thing. And Roosevelt writes back and basically says, who gives the right, or who has the right to call an emergency, this kind of situation. Mm-hmm. And I sort of believe that there had to have been more correspondence after that, but I got everything that was in the file, in that particular file. But there you can see that, you know, the Secretary of War is updating the president on this overflight in Los Angeles, and we know that the Secretary of the Navy was involved. I think the guy's name was Knox, was involved in this whole incident. And the other thing that we have that really is discussed sort of separately, which I would say that the president would have to know, and that was that it appears fairly certain that there were other crashes before Roswell, which would indicate that the government did know before Roswell what was going on, that Roswell was no big surprise, and that by the time they get to Roswell, they'd already realized what the nature of the UFO problem was. One of the crashes was one that Ryan Wood did an extensive write-up about in his book. This is a crash in Missouri, I believe it was 1942 or 1941, and I interviewed 2 women in Ohio last April. I went to Ohio to talk to these 2 women. They're in their 80s, and they tell the story about being told a story in 1948 by their father, who was a minister in Ohio by the name of Holt, and these 2 daughters on separate occasions were talked to by their father, and he had described the fact that a cousin, the Secretary of State, the longest ranking Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, was a cousin to this minister, and that he had stated that he had been in Washington, D.C., and Cordell Hull had taken him to the Capitol building, and in a sub-basement area of the Capitol building, had taken him into a room and had shown him what he described as 3 creatures in jars, and also a crashed sort of metallic ship with no wings that was in the corner that was so light that you could actually lift it. So these 2 women were told this story, and the one woman, Aileen, who told me this story, stated she was very, very sure as to when the story was told to her, and that was because her father very rarely talked to her. He was a very busy minister, and that he had told this story when her kids were very, very young. She remembered being in the yard with the kids, and the father came up and said, now that the new generation is here, there's probably something I should tell you what I've seen, and he described this story. Now, if Cordell Hull knew what was going on, and Cordell Hull knew where the bodies were and was showing it to people, I'm pretty sure that Roosevelt would have known what was going on.
Right. Right. So 1942, the overflight in L.A., well documented. In fact, I seem to remember seeing some clippings on one of the UFO pages regarding that. So we were aware something was happening already. Of course, that's right in the middle of the European war before it had gone to World War at that point. I think it was 1943 that they actually started to nudge towards the final conflict. I think that's how it came about. So this must have got the War Department and the powers that be all jittery, especially with war in Europe raging.
Yeah, and the Los Angeles thing, I believe, happened after Pearl Harbor, and that was what made them sort of edgy, that there was, I guess, some rumors around that this may have been the Japanese, an attack on the West Coast. And even, in fact, and it's a bizarre story that's been going around ufology for many years that I really can't believe people sort of believe it. And one of the stories was that what the object was planes that were launched from submarines, Japanese submarines, which just makes me shake my head. Like, how do you get a plane inside a submarine and then launch it? It just doesn't make any sense to me. But that is one of the stories that was put out.
And especially something the size that it was and the shape that it was. It resembled nothing of a plane.
Yeah.
It was
apparently a huge object that was, you know, there for whatever it was, 30 minutes or whatever, and was pretty dramatic. I think what we basically come down to is that the president, there's an awful lot that goes on that people really don't see, and there's a lot that the president really can't change, really doesn't have any control over. And the prime example of that is the recent election of Barack Obama. When Barack was running, and I follow these things very closely, it was basically the thing like, this is the Messiah, this is the guy who's going to sort of rescue America, take us off the track that George Bush got us on, and reverse the course of American history. And if you take a look, it was a lot of hoopla, a lot of happy people when he was elected and figured this was going to change everything. And if you take a look at Barack Obama and you take a look at George Bush and you take a look at what's actually happened, very, very little has really actually changed. For example, Americans are still being spied on by their phone calls. They're still in Iraq. They've actually increased the war in Afghanistan. And of all the secrets, for example, Barack, I think, was briefed 2 days after he was elected, the big briefing where they give him all the secrets and all this sort of stuff. And I've sort of pointed out to people, how many secrets has he actually let go? Absolutely none. Forget about ufology or UFOs, which would be the what the Canadians described in the 1950s, the most highly classified secret in the United States, rated 2 points higher than the H-bomb. And this is when the H-bomb was being developed. This was a very, very highly classified, closely held secret. Now, if Barack Obama hasn't released any of the very minor secrets that he may have been told, why would anybody expect him to sort of upset the apple cart and release the most highly classified secret they have? That's sort of where I've gone now. I've done a lot of work on presidents, and I've sort of gotten at times very discouraged by being at presidential archives and stuff and going in there and sitting there for a week and finding absolutely nothing. There really is no documents inside the presidential libraries which deal with UFOs, which either indicates that the president really didn't deal with the subject, doesn't really know what's going on, or it means that it's a very highly classified thing that is only dealt with orally, that they really don't produce any documents, and the documents are funneled away someplace. So what I've sort of been spending my time now is looking at the whole disclosure thing, because I think people, the way we work in the world is we sort of look at the world as sort of a dualistic world, that there's good and there's evil, and there's good people and bad people. And in ufology, we sort of see that we're trying to get the secret out. We're trying to reveal what's going on. That makes us the good people. and anybody who's covering up the secret who is in government becomes the bad people. And I think we've sort of gone off course with this. I don't think that's really what's actually going on, because whether you look at George Bush Sr., George Bush Jr., any of the presidents, you take a look at how they deal in normal life, and if you read their presidential documents, you'll find out that they're exactly the same as you and I. They've got kids, they've got grandkids, they want the best for future generations. So to assume that a president or people who are covering this up are evil and that they are doing the wrong thing, I think sort of gets us off course, because I think they have done what they think was right in covering it up. And so I started to work on this whole idea, and then Jimmy Carter was the inspiration of it. Or actually, let's go back one more step. When I went to university, when I was young, what I had studied was political science, and my main interest was Russian Soviet studies, because back in the 1970s, that was where it was at. It was the Cold War. It was Russia versus the United States. And anybody that worked on the Soviet Union would work on to become a criminologist in studying the Kremlin. And it was basically, I remember a story being told that you assumed that the Russians were all evil people, and that I remember the professor once saying, what would happen if you landed in the middle of Moscow and you said, okay, I'm here to rescue you, what would happen? Well, basically, the citizens would just basically shoot you, because they believe that their government's doing the right thing and that they're on the right course. So what criminologists did was they basically looked at what was going on in the Kremlin. And you would look at this person moves, that person moves, this person is getting elected, because it was a very secretive type of government, the same as the UFO situation is very secretive. So you're sort of reading between the lines, you're looking at movements, what people are saying, you're interpreting what people are saying. And that's the way I started to look at ufology, is to look at, especially Jimmy Carter was the inspiration. Jimmy Carter was a very religious man who believed in telling the truth. He had taught Sunday school since he was like 16 years old, and had taught every Sunday all the way through his presidency. Was this type of guy that I sat there, and he had gone out in the 1976 campaign, and he said, if I become president, I'm going to release all the information on UFOs. I had a UFO sighting. He went through the whole thing, and he goes into the presidency, and he doesn't say a thing. He just suddenly shuts up. He doesn't say anything, and now he's even in a position where he's actually saying, well, no, he really doesn't believe it's extraterrestrial, and you know, there's really no evidence, and he's going down this path. And I sat there, and I wondered, if you were a guy who wanted the UFO secret out, and you ended up in the White House, what is it that changes the president's mind? What is it that they come in and tell the president that suddenly will flip somebody? For example, Barack Obama. Barack Obama said, you know, there's too much secrecy. We've got to release all this. We've got, you know, he's in this whole open government transparency. He walks into the presidency, and suddenly he's basically no different than any other president. And so that's the way I looked at the UFO situation. Was what is the briefing? What is it that they sit the president down that makes him say, yeah, you're right, it's not time for this to be released? And I look at all the sort of concepts of why is this thing being kept secret? Because I think it now goes beyond the president. I think it goes to basically a group that has been around for an awful long time, whether you want to call them the cabal or the MJ-12 or something. There is some sort of as Bill Clinton said when he was asked about why don't you do something about the UFO situation, he said, he was talking to Sarah McClendon, the long-time White House reporter. He said, Sarah, there's a government inside the government, and I don't control it. Yeah. And I think that is basically a situation that we find existing, and that when you sit down and you assume, number one, that the people who are covering this up aren't evil, that they are doing what they think is right, and you start looking at some of the things that might be told, it starts to make sense as to why they're covering it up. Now, that doesn't mean that it's right what they're doing, that they're covering it up, but the same as when you study the Soviet government, you have to understand how they think, what's happening behind the scenes in order to move ahead and to try to get that right. Because basically the assumption that they're evil and that they're trying to cover it up and that they'll kill you if you you know, you try to speak out, I think that's all stuff that's led us down the wrong path. I think there are some very scary and legitimate things that if you were the president, you say, well, you know, maybe we'll leave this for the next guy. I really don't want to touch this.
Yeah, I think Barack Obama, when he was on the campaign trail, was full of piss and vinegar, is the polite way of saying it, and had lots of really good ideas. But I think once he became president and they actually brought out the real books, the real stories, and laid it out to him, I think he may have sat back and said, oh, my God. Oh, my God, what are we doing? What have we done? You know?
Sure. Yeah, and, so and people I, have to I realize think, that a president works by being reelected, that it's all votes, and that a lot of it, especially if you get very, very rich guys running, like, why would you run for president? Like, why would you take on a job like this? It's all status. It is image. I mean, they have, you know, that's why Ronald Reagan was such a good president, because he was an actor. He knew how to play the game. He knew it was all image, and you are a figurehead. And therefore, if you're in a situation where you're the guy who's to come out and release this thing, and you realize that you're about to go down the tubes, you know, Barack Obama worked an awful long time, and he's probably wanted this his whole life. He's not about to flush his presidency down the toilet. Yeah. And there are some things, when you look at the UFO situation, that are things that it's easy for us in the background to say, okay, we want you to release this. Same as Brock, when he was on the campaign trail, was saying, you know, we need this, we need transparency and sort of stuff. And then he gets into the presidency and he realizes transparency on all issues is going to cause you a lot of trouble, and he starts to second guess, do I really want to blow myself up here?
Right. There's and kind of a status message in our virtual studio from RD. Could it be that Obama is just a puppet, just as those before him? I think somewhat he is. Much like in England, Sarah Ferguson blew the lid off the Grey Men, that there was a government within a government that actually controlled everything, and the government was basically to keep the public happy.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. He does have a lot of power, but he is basically a figurehead. If you study the presidency and you study what they do, it's absolutely unbelievable how they protect the president and protect the president's image. And you know, speeches, State of the Union speeches written, will go up to 30 drafts. 25 different agencies will sign off on it. I mean, he basically is stand on the white line. Here's your speech, and it's carefully orchestrated what happens from minute to minute as the president moves around. You know, you can tell all these bizarre stories when you study the presidencies about, you know, George Bush, his image. He had a bad image. And stuff like, you know, he was seen as the rich oil man from Texas. And so you'd have things, and this happens all the time, where he's having a picture taken of a bunch of people, and everybody's told to take their ties off. And that is because he doesn't want a bunch of people who look like they're rich. So it would look like the common man. Here's George Bush taking a picture with all these people with their ties off. Or Barack Obama, where they would, you know, they would spread out the audience behind him. So you'd have so many black people, so many foreign people, to make it look like he was a person who was appealing to all different people. And they would actually say who got to sit behind the president, and it was very carefully orchestrated, and the whole presidency is like that. So if you get a situation, and I've always said, it was a couple of the big reasons that you might, if you fully understood the situation, if you're the president, it's easy for us to say, okay, the president should release this. But if you're the president, I mean, are you really going to step forward and say, well, you know, the aliens are here, there's nothing we can do about it. They are abducting people, and sorry, there's absolutely nothing we can do. They are, it appears, trying to put people on the ground. They're using these hybrids who are getting more advanced so that we can't really tell who they are. And, oh, by the way, we're trying to figure out what's going on here. So secretly, the way we've studied abductions is we have re-abducted people, and we've drugged them, and we have tried to get out of these abductees, these poor people who have been abducted. We've re-abducted them, drugged them, and then tried to get them to tell us what's going on, tried to get the implants out of them, put our own implants. I mean, what president in his right mind is going to stand up if he knows that the government, or that they've actually run disinformation programs against people? Are you going to stand up and say, yeah, we know they've been mutilating cattle, and we've known this, and we've known the whole situation, and you're just looking at tens of thousands of lawsuits, and it's a good idea to say transparency, and as Steve Bassett always said, truth is the ultimate thing. It really doesn't matter. Truth will always get you the farthest ahead. But when you take a look at a president, his situation is it's all status. You got to get reelected. You need votes. You don't want your popularity going down to 10%. You don't want to be the guy who's in charge of something that you really can't control. The president is presented to the American people as Mr. Power. He has all the power. Everything's positive. Everything's under control. And it's very difficult to stick that guy up there and make him look totally inept, totally stupid, out of control. That's not, you never see a president really actually standing up and saying, yeah, the economy is, you know, heading in the tank and there's nothing we can do about it. It's always, we got this thing under control. Don't worry. Even though it may be going down, we know what we're doing. It's all under control, because that's the way he elected. I'm the smartest guy. I'm the guy that can run the country. I'm the guy with all the answers. And you don't really want to stick him out there and make him look like the guy who doesn't have all the answers.
Yeah, I hope that Barack Obama does come through with some disclosure sooner or later. We definitely are ready for some information. I know the UFO people around the world are getting hungry for information. England is releasing at an incredible rate, and a number of the European countries have started to release. Grant, hold on to that thought. We're going to take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about that some more. I see a 480 caller that is up online. I do believe that may be our first guest, Richard. Richard, we will catch you at the top of the hour, sir.
Paul Dale Roberts from HPI Paranormal.
There's no turning back now.
Good friend Paul Dale Roberts from HPI Paranormal.
Mr. Paul Dale Roberts.
Paul Dale Roberts and Shaman Macabre McCabe. HPI Paranormal. Check out the archives. Your host, Colin Knight.
Paul Dale Roberts and Shaman McCabe, of course, can be seen on HPI Paranormal website. Go over there and have a look at the background video for their visit to Chichen Itza. Did you hear me, Paul? Chichen Itza.
Paul Dale Roberts, our James Bond of the paranormal. Check out the archives.
David Baker is a psychic medium who makes contact with spirit guides, angels, and past over loved ones. He passes messages of love, healing, and sometimes forgiveness. David is a certified medium and angel therapy practitioner under Dr. Doreen Virtue, PhD.
Check the Night Zone archives for Mr. David Baker.
David Emtor, phone lines are open. 347-324-3287. 347-324-3287. Welcome to the Shadows of the Night Zone. Your host, Colin Knight.
David Baker will be back with us on the 22nd of this month, 22nd of September, 10 p.m. Eastern Time. It's a Tuesday. And we're going to get into a little bit more to this special spirit that seems to be buzzing around me. David Baker, September the 22nd.
Phone lines are open. 347-324-3287. 347-324-3287. Welcome to the Shadows of the Night Zone. Your host, Colin Knight. The following program is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. Although the Night Zone takes all precautions to bring you quality information, the Night Zone and its subsidiaries or affiliates do not accept responsibility for information provided by our guests or hosts. The Night Zone is merely the purveyor of information. You, the audience, shall judge the quality of information offered by our guests or host. We remind all of our listeners, KVAD Emtor.
Welcome to the Shadows
of the Night Zone. In the darkness of the Night Zone, we examine the works of Nostradamus through the eyes of John Hoag from HoagProphecy.com.
of the Nostradamus prophecy of the Antichrist, decoded by John Hogue, codenamed
Mabus.
Nostradamus and the Antichrist, codenamed Mabus, with John Hogue.
I'm Colin Knight, your guide. John Hogue, GoProxy.com, in the Night Zone archives. Check the Night Zone website on LoveZoneRadio.com. This is a pre-recorded show. Please do not call. You are in the Night Zone on BlogTalkRadio.com. Your host, Colin Knight.
Actually, it is a live show. It is not pre-recorded tonight, and I have with me Grant Cameron from presidentialufo.com. And Grant, before the break there, we were talking about cover-ups, and why do you think Europe is suddenly disclosing as much information as they are out of the blue?
Well, I would have a little bit different opinion than people about the disclosure. What basically has happened is the Britons really didn't have a Freedom of Information Act request situation, whereas the Americans had it. But what's happening around the world is people are not disclosing the UFO stuff. They're disclosing UFO sighting files, which is a little bit different. Most of the stuff that's being released is nothing more than confidential documents. The Canadians released theirs back in 1978. They were releasing their material. If you're looking for the secret and the top secret material and the documents as to how it all fits together and who's running the show and what kind of recoveries they've made, what kind of back engineering they've done, none of that material is in any of the, whether it's the Irish or the British or the Brazilians or the French, or all that material is still secret. It's their citing reports, and basically there's pressure. So there is some disclosure. They are basically just dumping their material to say, you know, we've got this material. We really don't need it. Nobody who's in the cabal who's controlling this stuff really cares whether this stuff comes out, because there's really nothing there of any major consequence. The Americans did release majority of their material that they had under the Carter administration. Jimmy Carter came out with hyped up Freedom of Information Act request stuff. And if you take a look at the vast majority of the documents that came out in the United States, for example, I think it was 1,500 pages of FBI documents, the Navy documents, the CIA documents, all that material came out under Jimmy Carter. So a lot of that material was already released. In some places, for example, in Canada, if you've ever talked to Chris Rakowski is a private citizen. He works at the University of Manitoba, where I am. And he gets all the sighting reports from the Canadian military, from the Canadian Department of Transport. All this material is just sent to him. The Canadian government really doesn't care what they're doing. But you'll see the material is really not the high-level material. It's the sighting reports. So Chris will phone me up. Pardon me?
So it's reports just to appease the masses, so to speak, but not really.
Well, it is their sighting stuff. It's like the Americans describe the Blue Book stuff, for example. That was their sighting reports. So all the material that the sighting reports goes through, and it's anything that was really good. And there was one document, I can't really reference exactly what it was, one of the early documents where they said anything of any consequence is put through classified channels and doesn't become part of Blue Book. For example, one example of that is Coleman, Bill Coleman, Colonel Bill Coleman, who was the public relations officer for Blue Book back in the 1960s, had himself a UFO sighting when he was a B-25 bomber pilot. They actually chased the UFO and chased this thing across the country, and he stated that his sighting report didn't, and he was the PR guy for Blue Book, he said his sighting report did not end up in Blue Book. And so there's a lot of material that gets funneled off. Anything that's really, really good will get funneled off and sent where it is supposed to go. For another example of that is Jimmy Carter, when he came in, said, I will release all the UFO sighting stuff, but if there's something that is classified related to new technologies, that stuff I wouldn't release. So if you're going to brief the president, you say, well, you know, the sighting report, this guy saw this, this guy saw that, we'll release that, but this crash and the material and the stuff we did at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and the Nitinol, all that stuff, we're not releasing that. That's classified, and that's properly classified. It is national security. It's sources and methods. It's all this sort of stuff. And, Mr. President, we simply can't release this because if the Bin Laden gets a hold of this stuff, well, he's gonna go to town with this. Do you really want to be fighting Bin Laden with this kind of technology? And you can just type up so many different reasons why the classified material has to remain the classified material. And that's what I'm saying with Barack Obama. I mean, how much material? He has been given piles and piles of classified material on all sorts of different projects. There's hundreds of black projects in the United States on all sorts, not just UFOs, all sorts of stuff. And absolutely none of that has been released by Barack Obama because it's properly classified. It's stuff that is military. It's, you can say, you know, it's military technology. We can't release this. And the president has his hands tied. If he comes out, he looks like a traitor. He releases stuff that maybe the Russians have. You release your 60% of the stuff you know, and the Russians have the other 40% that you need, and suddenly the Russians say thank you very much, and they've got everything that you need. So it's a much more complicated problem, I think, than people realize. And in the end, I think it comes down to you and I and the people on the street forcing the issue out. And I've had a number of sort of discussions with people who've disagreed with me, prominent researchers who say that, you know, I'm totally off base. I say that the UFO situation is no different than any other social or political movement of the 19th, 20th, or 21st century. If you take a look, and Hillary Clinton talked about this when she's on the campaign trail, people tend to forget that all the things that we have today, all the major developments, whether it be the African-American civil rights movement, whether it's the gay rights movement, whether it's women's right to vote, which is the most prominent one, these things didn't happen overnight. People had to fight to get these things out in the open. And Hillary Clinton, when she was campaigning, reminded people of the women's right to vote. It started in 1848 when they first came out and said that women should have the right to vote. They didn't get the right to vote till 1917. Now, that's an important issue, just like UFOs. But we sort of think that we've sort of, it's sort of the, I don't know if it's the socialist sort of thing. People sort of, you get the impression people will say, okay, you have a right to vote, and if you use your vote, you can change the system. And basically, that's not really what happens. We have the impression that, for example, with Barack Obama, if we elect Barack Obama, he's going to save us. He's going to give us, better transparency. He's going to give us, more honesty. He's going to give us health care. He's going to get us out of the war in Iraq. He's going to do this. He's going to do that. And he becomes the Messiah. And we sort of look at politicians as people like, we're in a humanistic type society where God is dead, where, and politics has replaced that. There's no more Santa Claus, but there is a politician who, if we use our right to vote and to vote for this guy, he's going to give us everything we want. And that's the way they set it up. What do you want? Okay, that's what you'll get. And he reads the polls and he sees what are the 10 most popular issues, what are the 10 most prominent Christmas presents that people want. And then the politician stands up and says, this is what I'll get you. I'll get you these particular issues. So we've got an impression, or it's in the back of people's minds, that the government is there to do things for us, to give us things and this sort of stuff. And that's not the way the world works. The way the world works is you get it for yourself, that it is up to you. It is up to, if UFOs is that important for the UFO community, it is up to us to promote the issue. It is us to promote it. It is not up to the government to come out and give it to us. America, and I mentioned this from the last time I lectured in the States, America was built on hard work and people's dedication. It was not built on a handout. And right. So we sort of think that the government should disclose this sort of thing. And I say that no major movement, no major, for example, we can we can say the ecology movement. We say, oh, this is prominent. This is the way it is. It was never that way. Back when I was young, ecology, these people were fighting for this. This is a long time thing, and they fought their way to get these issues where they're now generally accepted. And I think UFOs is the same as that, same as the gay rights. They had to fight to get those rights, women's right to vote. It's all the same. It's a social, a political movement, and we can't be sitting back and expecting somebody to come and go and do the dirty work that we don't want to do. For example, one of the prominent messages that people say is they ufologists will come out and say, we really don't know what this is. And it's nonsense. I've talked to researchers. They'll talk about, you know, extraterrestrial. But the minute they get in front of a camera or in a prominent thing, they say, well, we really don't know what this is. It could be a lot of things. We just know it's an important issue, and Congress should do a congressional investigation. But why should Congress do the dirty work? We are afraid to come out and say this thing's extraterrestrial, that there's something, and put it right out front as to what is going on. We want the government to come out and say, oh, it's extraterrestrial, and release the bad news. But the government is the same situation as you and I, that a lot of researchers are afraid to say what they really think is going on, because it's an issue that is, you're going to get scorn and ridicule by being involved in the issue. So everybody wants to be cool. Nobody really wants to be involved, but we want to be prominent. We want to be look good. So we really don't want to say what it is. We want the government to come out and make the disclosure, or we want Congress to do an investigation, and they come out and say, oh, it's extraterrestrial. Then we say, oh, we knew it all along. See, we knew it was important, and that makes us look good. But Congress is the same as you and I. These guys are total gutless wonders. They are not going to stand up and say this thing's extraterrestrial. If we, after 62 years in this field, cannot stand up and say, it sure looks like it's extraterrestrial, it sure looks like it's alien, if we can't after 62 years, how can you expect a bunch of congressmen who are there to look good, to get votes, not to rock the boat, to get half of the Senate, 60% of the 60 senators, to vote on an issue like this? They can't vote on the simplest issue they're fighting. And there are lots of things. You know, 47 million people in the United States don't have health insurance. You can't get that through because it gets filibustered and people block it. This is a much more deadly issue. And a lot of people, for example, I'll give you some examples. James Fox, when he was promoting his movie, was up on Capitol Hill. He made a visit to all the congressmen and senators. And so did Stephen Greer, and both of them were told exactly the same thing. There are a couple of senators who are very sympathetic to the UFO issue, but they both said the same thing. They said, you get this thing going, and we're there with you. As soon as you get a groundswell of people, we'll back you on this thing. Because politicians, people forget, politicians are not leaders, they're followers. They look for the parade, and once they see where the parade is, they want to get into the parade. But if there's no parade, they're not going to step out and take the flak for things that – and this is going to be a very unpopular issue with a lot of different public interest groups, with a lot of religious groups. And politicians are not the type of people that are going to do it. They're totally gutless. They basically are relying on popular issues. And it's up to us to make it popular and acceptable, and then the politicians will jump in and want to take a lead in the parade.
And that's what Night Zone is all about, is getting the information out there for the people to make the decision, to make the pressure, to get further information. Now, you've been at this a fairly long time, Grant. You had a life-changing event in 1975. So tell me about this Charlie Red Star.
Well, my experience, I think, was very critical. It's similar to what happens to a lot of ufologists. I was, I think, 22 at the time. I was going to university, and what happened was, I live in Manitoba, and this is a town maybe 30 miles southwest of the big city where I live. And I had absolutely no interest whatsoever in UFOs. I can never even recall even having thought of the issue. I was very interested in life after death, which is something I'm still very interested in, the research going on with that. But in terms of UFOs, what had happened was, there was this was right at the end of the Vietnam War, and I think that tied into why the sightings were taking place here. But anyway, the sighting that I had happened 2 weeks after the end of the Vietnam War, and what had happened was this thing kept being seen, and it was called, it was so popular, it was so seen so many times in this town of Carmen that people actually gave it a name. It had a red sort of glow around it, and they called it Charlie Red Star. And it was there almost every single night, and people would, from the city would drive the 30 miles out there. And I told my friends, we used to drive around the big city here, and I said, you know, rather than driving around the city, why don't we go out there and see what everybody's looking at? And I, it was in the newspapers, it was, and then the TV, local TV station, actually, they had it cornered on the ground. And the guy filmed this thing jumping off the ground as it jumped off the ground. This was a film that went around the world. NBC picked it up. It became a very famous film. And when that happened, then I said to my friends, this is crazy. I mean, this is May. This is maybe 3 months into the flap. I said, come on, let's go to Carmen and see what's going on. We drove out to Carmen, and it's almost like, you know, you buy the lottery ticket. You think you're going to win the lottery ticket. Went out there, and we drove around into town, out of the town, driving around. We're looking at planets and stars, and I really wasn't familiar with astronomy. I just knew that there was nothing there that really looked all that impressive to me. So we were driving out of the town, and I was with two friends, and I wasn't driving. My friend was driving, and we drove. He said, we'll drive back into town one more time, and if we don't see anything, that's it. And if I hadn't seen anything, I would be a skeptic, just like all the rest of the clowns in the world that really aren't into it, because I was very skeptical at the point. And we drove back in, and this thing, there was absolutely no doubt. It came right in front of the car. It was maybe half a mile down the road. It was bobbing up and down. It was pulsing red. And everybody in the car, and I've sort of described this to people, that if you haven't really seen a very definite UFO, maybe you've seen a light in the sky, but to see a really defined UFO where there's absolutely no doubt what you're looking at is a life-changing experience, because nobody in the car said, we'd been going for an hour and we'd been looking and, well, is that it? No. And nobody said, is that what everybody's looking at? Is that what it is? Everybody immediately said, there it is. Everybody instinctively knew this was the object that everybody's talking, because it was so dramatic. My son is a pilot. My father is a pilot. I never became a pilot, but I live on the Winnipeg glide path where the planes come over. I've seen lots of planes, and there was absolutely nothing that could even compare to what we had seen. And what happened at that point was we jumped out of the car. The car was still moving, and I watched this thing, and it just floored me. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. It was sort of like you'd won the lottery. You'd finally bought a lottery ticket, and you'd won. So I went out there 2 nights later. I talked all my friends into going out there. There was about 25 people there, and we were there for about an hour, and my friends all said, "Ah, Cameron, you're crazy. This is garbage." I said, "No, you got to see this thing, man. If you saw this thing, it's unbelievable." They said, "Ah, we're hungry. We're going back." And this is 12:30 in the morning. "We're going back to Winnipeg for pizza." "You're crazy." And they took off, and like 20 minutes later, this thing came in, and it came right at us the second night. And it was bouncing around the sky. It was just, and people were yelling and screaming. Some girl couldn't see it. She was crying. Some guy's taking photographs one after another. It was like a pandemonium at a football game. And at that point, I just said, why is nobody in? Because the story had been going on for a number of months. And I said, you know, here's a whole town that's seeing this thing. Why is nobody investigating this thing? Why is nobody talking to the people? So what I did is I basically quit university and just went out there, and every second day I was there, and I interviewed all the people, and I put together a manuscript which basically described 18 months of sightings in and around this one town, extending out about maybe 20 miles on each side, and put it out and went to have the thing published, and had the local giant publisher in Winnipeg say to me, "You may believe in this kind of stuff, count me among the unbelievers." And that was my rejection letter. So it really didn't go anywhere. But the manuscript was put out, and it was an extensive manuscript to describe the films that were taken, the people that saw it, all this sort of stuff. And that's basically what started. It just was sort of a phenomena that I saw. And it wasn't something that, you know, I had to question whether it was. There was no doubt in my mind what I was looking at. This was very spectacular. Didn't see any aliens or anything, but it was something I'd seen a number of times. I used to take tours of people to see the small little, what we call ground lights, little lights that they would drop down and leave on the ground, and we'd flash lights at them and take pictures and infrared. And I was out there, and it just sort of consumed my life. And at that point, I decided, I know what this thing is. why is there no answer to this? And that's when I went to investigate what the Canadian government was doing, because one of the radar techs who had had a sighting there said, well, if you really want to know what UFOs is all about, you should investigate what the guy that ran the Canadian government program on UFOs did. Well, he was real wacko. He was talking to the aliens, and they were landing in his yard. He was talking to the aliens? And that's when I went after Wilbur Smith, and I flew as a young kid to Ottawa to interview his wife. Smith was dead, talked to his wife, and remember driving to her son's place, and she's talking about half of this alien and this and that, and it just blew me away. And so it went on to go higher and higher and higher levels to get an answer to what I saw back in May of 1975. Because to me, there was no doubt what I was looking at, and it was just basically my search to try to actually get to a sort of a confirmation of what I had seen.
Yeah. Grant, it's absolutely fascinating information. I brought you in a short notice, sir, and I do appreciate your time. We do have to bail out of this first hour, and I do appreciate you, sir. I'm going to have the gang get a hold of you, and let's set up a full interview so we can get all of this information out in short order. How does that sound?
That sounds good. I appreciate you having me and showing interest in what I do, and hopefully I added something to what people are looking for.
Oh, absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt. Grant Cameron from presidentialufo.com. Grant, once again, thank you for your time, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Grant Cameron, you got to check out the website. He happens to be a fellow Canadian, but it's presidentialufo.com. And there's so much up there. There is so much information up there. It would take hours, if not days, to be able to go through it all. We're coming back with our second guest. Hopefully that's Richard that's up on the 480 line. We'll be right back right after this.
Welcome to the shadows of the night.
In the dead of night, when thy summer wounds shall not heal from the wind which howls about your being. In the dead of night, when your friends have gone and you sit huddled around the castle's fire. In the dead of night, when all is dark, who will you be tonight?
I am the darkness and the night, a shadow in your dreams.
There is nothing wrong with your internet connection.
There is nothing wrong with your software.
This is the Night Zone, thinking outside the box.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, madam and messieurs. Welcome to
the Night Zone.
This is a live event.
There is nothing wrong with your computer. There is nothing wrong with your audio or your video.
We
are controlling transmission.
For the next hour,
and we will control all that is here.
Let me repeat.
There is nothing wrong with your computer.
You are about to participate in a great adventure.
You are about to experience the awe and mystery
which reaches from the inner mind
to the shadows of the Night Zone with Colin Knight.
The following program is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. Although the Night Zone takes all precautions to bring you quality information, the Night Zone and its subsidiaries or affiliates do not accept responsibility for information provided by our guests or hosts. The Night Zone is merely the purveyor of information. You, the audience, shall judge the quality of information offered by our guests or host. We remind all of our listeners,
KVADM Tour,
your host, Colin Knight.
Tonight, we have a full agenda. Starting us off tonight in our 90-minute show is Richard Phillips, author of The Second Ship, a book from the series The Roe Agenda.
In the darkness of the Night Zone, we examine the works of Nostradamus through the eyes of John Hogue from HogueProphecy.com.
We shall look into the shadows of the Nostradamus prophecy of the Antichrist, decoded by John Hogue, codenamed
Mabus.
Nostradamus and the Antichrist, codenamed Mabus, with John Hogue.
I'm Colin Knight, your guide.
John Hogue will be back with us in the fall. Until then, check the archives of John Hogue at HogueProphecy.com.
I'll go crazy.
For my
lines are open. 347-324-3287. 347-324-3287. You are in the Night Zone on blogtalkradio.com. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Colin Knight.
And as we go into the extended part of the night, let me explain what's happened here. Is Richard Phillips was scheduled up as our first guest and Grant Cameron as our second. Unfortunately, Richard couldn't make an instant contact and we lost him on the connection. So Grant came up first and Richard is up second. Good evening, Richard, and welcome to the Night Zone, sir. I do hope that is you that has been holding all this time.
Oh, yeah, it's me, and I apologize for the little lateness, but I got a little caught up in traffic. But I did enjoy I enjoyed listening to Grant during that first hour.
Absolutely. Grant's full of information, and, of course, I can't get enough out of him fast enough, so we're going to have to...
He doesn't have a lot to say, does he?
No, not a lot at all. He's got a lot of information, that boy. I tell you what, Richard, let's just jump to a quick preview of who and what you're all about, and then we'll come back and chat. How's that sound?
That sounds great.
I just my producer's waving me off here. So we're
here,
gonna jump.
How about if I give the brief preview?
There you go. Go for it.
Sure. Well, I was actually born in Roswell, New Mexico, back in 1956, which is interesting after your last guest. But I grew up in a little town not far from there called Lincoln, New Mexico. It's about 60 miles from Roswell. And actually went to a high school. These were not big towns. My high school had a grand total graduating class, including me, of 12 people. So... This was not a big place. So after I graduated from high school, I headed off to West Point. And so you can imagine it was quite a culture shock coming from such a small school into New York. Anyway, there was a kind of a funny thing when I got to New York City, just to show you what a small town boy I was. I got there with... I guess it was three other guys from New Mexico that went to New York City with me. And I didn't even know at the time when we took the cab whether the amount on the meter was something that, you know, we individually paid or whether that was something that was, you know, a group total. So
learning curve.
So there was quite a learning curve, and but I made it through West Point. After I got out of West Point, I did the Army Ranger thing, and then, excuse me, and then the Army sent me back to the Naval Postgraduate School, where I got my master's in nuclear physics.
Okay, so you get your master's in nuclear physics, and then how long has it been since? Let's just back up. As you get your master's. How long had the idea of your book been on the burner?
It's been on the burner actually for quite a long time. I got my my master's in nuclear physics. I actually did my thesis work at Los Alamos National Laboratory, which is a very interesting place. And then after I finished that, the Army sent me back to Lawrence Livermore National Lab, where I did a number of years of classified research. And for the last several years, I've continued, my thesis work at Los Alamos was on a subject called Cherenkov radiation, which is used in neutrino detection, high-energy gamma ray research, and that type of thing.
Some pretty heavy stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, so anyway, I've continued simulations, advanced aeronautic computing, and that type of thing ever since that time. So I started actually writing my series, The Row Agenda. By the way, I want to take just a brief second to say thank you to all those readers out there that have put The Row Agenda in the top 10 bestsellers on Amazon Sci-Fi for the last several weeks. So I appreciate that.
Fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. Yeah. And I've looked through it, and I got to tell you, you got me on the edge of my seat. It's exactly the kind of novels that get me thinking and make me go,
Well, you know, one of the things about it, I think a lot of people ask me about too, is you know, I get a lot of questions. You know, with my background, having worked in a lot of these places, that I think most of us really wonder when they, you know, when you hear things like what Grant was talking about, and you see what's available as public information on exciting technologies that the government's working on right now, or that, you know, that not the government, that just scientists around the world are working on, it makes people wonder, well, I think they'd like to take a peek and wonder what's going on that's highly classified if all this other amazing stuff's going on that's not classified.
Right.
And since I had the privilege of working at some of those places on those type of projects, I get a lot of questions about how much of the second ship and the technologies in the Roe agenda and the scenario of the Roe agenda is based on some semblance of reality. Now,
right.
Now, one thing I have to always caveat is, you know, with the background I come from and the classification levels that I operated in, you know, there are certainly limitations on what I can talk about. But at the same time, what I tried to do in the Roe Agenda series was put as much real science in there as possible, plus a flavor of some of the things that we are very, very close on. Now, whether these things are from reverse engineering of alien technologies like the scenario in the second ship, I can't comment directly on, but I think I think when people see what's about to happen over this next 7 years, it's going to raise a lot more questions than are out there right now, because we are getting ready to roll out a variety of breakthrough technologies, some of which I talk about in the second ship, but many of which are going to be incredibly startling.
Right. Now, would you say that these technologies could possibly be, and I mean possibly be, some form of back engineering?
I won't discount that. You know, just to give a little bit of a flavor to your listeners, that is exactly the story in my series, the Roe Agenda series. Essentially, the president comes out right at the beginning of the series and announces to the public, like we'd all like to hear, that the federal government has had a program for a number of decades trying to reverse engineer a damaged alien craft. And the only reason he comes out and announces it is because they've made some recent breakthroughs, current day, that are just too important. I mean, he can't keep them bottled up anymore. They finally cracked the code, you might say. And so that spins up my set of novels based on that particular scenario. But getting back to your question, you know, there's a bunch of things that are happening right now that everybody's aware of that are about to have a revolutionary type of effect. And I won't directly say whether these are alien technologies. I'll leave that to the judgment of other people. But, for example, one of the things that a lot of people think is an outlandish technology that's in the second ship is this technology that allows the direct linkage of a person's mind with a computer system. Okay,
mm-hmm.
But I mean, there's news stories out right now of all kinds of research going on to do exactly that. Everything from allowing the blind to see, allowing paralyzed people to move the mouse cursor on computer screens with just thinking, you know, they put on the right kind of headset, they think about what they want to do, and the computer does it. Voice recognition, pattern recognition. There are some frightening technologies, actually, that involve really an analysis and computer recognition of the patterns of our brainwaves. So these are all publicly available pieces of information. And what one of the things I've been watching for a number of years is indications of something that was a big subject of research for the last several decades, which is euphemistically known as artificial intelligence research.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially that was pretty much regarded as a huge failure,
right.
Because we could not make any significant progress along those lines. But right now, progress is being made, but it's being made in unexpected ways. We still don't understand. We don't have a good clue of how that whole equation works. How do you design a computer that learns and thinks? But what I've been believing for some time is that when it happens, it's going to happen not in a way we expect. Computers are getting closer and closer to learning on their own. In fact, they are learning on their own right now. And one of the indicators that people can see is there's this commonly known subject called Moore's Law. And Moore's Law, essentially since the start of the 70s, said that now this is an oversimplification, but he said essentially that every 2 years, the number of transistors in a computer doubles, and that will continue. And it was an indication of the processing power of computers, doubling every 2 years. Well, toward the middle of the 90s, a large number of computer scientists predicted that was going to start petering out because the transistors were getting so small that we were approaching quantum problems on the microchips. The wires were too close together, the little etchings, so that electrons started to bleed over from one wire to the other type of thing.
Yeah.
So they thought we were going to run out of room and that was going to slow down. But actually the opposite has happened. What we've seen over the last few years is there are indications that there's an acceleration even beyond the exponential growth that Moore predicted. And there is a very good reason for that. That reason is as computers start to become involved in designing themselves, that type of exponential growth is just going to get faster and faster and faster. And so I would speculate right now that, we are probably four computer cycles. By that I mean four of these two-year more development cycles away from such startling, not just the breakthroughs, but I mean the completely designed working systems that can essentially learn on their own.
Right.
Being common in the public. And when that happens, there is not going to be a world that we recognize in any meaningful way, thinking of it from today's terms.
Yeah, I think if we were to step back 70 years, 75 years, which isn't that far back in mankind's existence, we were still stuffing coal into boilers to make steam. And that was the new power of the day. And look where we are today. I mean, it's in 75 years, our learning curve for technology has exploded. And I do agree with you. I don't think it was done on our own. If we've been left to our own devices.
There's these times in history, which you've covered on your show many times, when it doesn't seem within our grasp to have the type of breakthrough that we do.
No.
Going back a long way in history, and a lot of people have speculated that this is because we're getting some outside help. I think people just need to use their minds. One of the messages I have within the second ship is, people need to question for themselves what they're being told. I mean, whether it's by scientists, whether it's by the government, the you know, what you're hearing may not be the truth. You know, it may not even be close to the truth. And but I think people have within themselves a very good capacity for recognizing something that just doesn't feel right, doesn't sound right when they come across it. I think a lot of people don't pay attention to that. But I think, you know, when people hear things that just don't seem valid, a good example is right now in our in physics, in the sciences, the scientists like to think that they are pretty close to having a model that explains everything. You know, that they're almost done. But the funny thing about that is that happens every generation. And if you look back 100 years at any point in our history, what the model that scientists thought they had down 100 years back is practically laughable. And I guarantee you 100 years from now, the model that says the speed of light there is no way around the speed of light, conservation of energy is an absolute fact, things like that are going to be just as laughable as some of the other concepts.
Yeah, I mean, less than 100 years ago, we were using leeches as medicinal and bleeding people to get rid of their bad blood to cure them. And, I mean, we were carving people's body parts off left, right, and center in the name of science that we knew about the human being, and we really didn't. Richard, I tell you what, I've just got a green signal. We will go to the top of the hour with you tonight, sir. We'll give you a full hour, and when we come back, let's talk a little bit about the second ship and the premise of the story. I'll give you a few minutes to do some privates, and then we'll be back.
All right, thank you.
Sounds like we're getting thrown to a break. We'll be right back with Richard Phillips, author of The Second Ship, a book from the series The Rogue Agenda, right after this.
Much question at all, but there's life throughout the universe. We're not alone in the universe at all. No, for sure we're not alone. I happen to be privileged enough to be in on the fact that we have been visited on this planet, and the UFO phenomenon is real, although it's been covered up by our governments for quite a long time.
Fly by the comets, visit asteroids, visit the moon of Mars. There's a monolith there, a very unusual structure on this little potato-shaped object that goes around Mars once in 7 hours. When people find out about that, they're going to say, who put that there? God put it there.
The question is, when you study, when you look at all that, is it myth, is it mythology, or did it really happen? I believe it all really happened.
The Aquarian Age is a time of greater spontaneity. It's going to be a time where the era of the great faith-based religion of the Piscean Age will fade and be replaced by religions that are more scientific. Rather than to believe, the next 2,000 years is about knowing.
Are in the Night Zone with Colin Knight.
Richard Phillips, author of The Second Ship, a book from the series The Rogue Agenda, live in the Night Zone.
The ancient Sumerian text, just in a very broad overview, basically tell us that these Anunnaki came from space and landed on the Earth in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. They began to set up a colony that they called Eden.
Phone lines are open, 347-324-3287, 347-324-3287.
Your host, Colin Knight.
And we are back with Richard Phillips, author of The Second Ship, a book through the Roe Agenda series. So, Richard, just going back to Roswell for a little while, growing up as a kid there, that must have been a fantastic learning curve.
Well, you know, the funny thing about it is, well, I was born in Roswell, but I grew up close enough to there. And, you know, I'm sure you've been there, there's a lot of wide open country around there. Mm-hmm. And lots of ranches and back in the early days, I mean, Roswell's really gotten popular from a tourist perspective only in the last 20 years. But back in the in the 60s when I was growing up, the actual Roswell incident was well known around the area, but it was more or less regarded as something that people knew these local folks that had been involved in the incident. And, whether it's Mac Brazel or, who was just a cowboy, very unsophisticated. Most of these folks were fairly unsophisticated. And they really didn't have any reason or any background in dreaming up wild stuff like this. So I think the folks around the area where I grew up generally thought there was something to the story just because of the way the government reacted to the story and the way they treated the people that were trying to tell their story. So that government, the kind of a heavy-handed government reaction, and also the changing stories out of the government about trying to explain what these people had seen, really caused a lot of suspicion in the area that there must be something to it, because I think people that wouldn't have really wanted to believe it otherwise started to believe after the way the government reacted to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see how these people could have been caught up in the story, because from all indication, Roswell is a cotton factory town. So that's how it started in the late 1800s. And these people were just hard-working ranchers and hard-working folk that really were not plugged into the UFO type of lifestyle when this happened. But it changed that whole area forever. It's an amazing story.
Well, it certainly has. And I'm certainly not one of the experts like your previous guest and, some of the real history folks that have interviewed all of the all of the locals involved and put together all the backstory on it. But just from growing up in that area, it of course attracted my interest, got me started developing an interest in not just science, but what was science fact and what was science fiction.
Yeah. And at that time, 1947 was a very strange time. It was the dawn of television. It was the dawn of many things, and it's almost surreal, because these shows, The Outer Limits, that were coming through in the 60s and the likes, bringing all of this sci-fi that may have had grains of truth somehow sprinkled in it, and yet all of this mass that attacked the viewer with all of these. They came from Mars and all of the crazy stories that were brought from the fantasy of television.
I totally agree with you. I mean, the mid 40s to late 40s were a time of tremendous breakthroughs in technology. Of course, Los Alamos itself was created for the Manhattan Project, and which was the development of the atomic bomb. And I always think that anytime there's amazing breakthroughs that happen in technology, whatever their cause, there's always this dichotomy where it might be hugely beneficial to man, but everything that's that big a breakthrough also has tremendous risks associated with it. And if you remember the story, right when they were doing the first, or they were getting ready to do the first test of the atomic bomb out near White Sands, several scientists on the Manhattan Project were actually concerned they might set the atmosphere of the planet on fire. Now they looked at it and they said, well, that's fairly low probability, so let's go ahead and do the test. But luckily it didn't happen.
Right. There were those questions. Definitely, there were those questions. So let's get to the second ship a little bit. This is all surrounded a bunch of young fellas, if you will, that are just doing what teenagers do, and they come across a very secret, almost abandoned area.
Right. Well, let me give just a brief author's run through.
Right.
The story starts, like I mentioned, with the president. Well, after the prelude, the president comes out and announces they have had a ship and they've had some breakthroughs on it, and he's going to start rolling out these technologies, these quote beneficial technologies, to the public. But meanwhile, you know, the actual opening chapter is a flashback 30 years in the past, back to 1977, and there's this tunnel below Groom Lake. It's a huge place with railroad tracks that go down through it, and it's in this tunnel that the government has this damaged alien ship, and they've been trying since the 40s to try to reverse engineer the thing, and they've made no progress, zero. You know, they haven't been able to chip the paint on the thing. But it so happens, this is where we run into the one of the major characters in the book, a guy named, at the time he's this young, brilliant military research guy. But the scientists on that program have kind of lost interest. Well, that's not a good term. They've kind of lost some enthusiasm after spending 30 years working on the thing and making no progress. They're starting to take their weekends off, not working around the clock, doing that kind of thing. So this scientist, at the time he's got his master's degree, Donald Stevenson, gets permission to set up an experiment of his own design against the side of the spacecraft. And he gets permission, but only if he'll do it over Thanksgiving weekend and have everything put back like it was by the time the scientists come back in the following Monday. Well, his experiment ends up being the one that actually opens the ship. So then we flash forward to present day, and you mentioned one of the things I get asked all the time, since this is such an adult series, why did I pick three high school juniors as the main protagonists in this? Mm-hmm. And there's really two reasons for it. Number one, that just happens to be the same age of kid that every military in the world uses as their frontline soldier. You know, they're looking for those 17, 18-year-olds. And the reason for that is, if you think about teenagers, at that age, they have a very poor sense of their own mortality, for one thing. And for another thing is they're out to prove themselves, whether they're guys or girls. And these three young people are bright young people. Their dads work at the Los Alamos National Laboratory, and they're out before the school year starts, rock climbing, doing whatever. They end up stumbling on this cave and finding this second ship, not the one the government has. And they quickly discover what the reader discovers early on, is that there were actually two ships that arrived back in the 40s. And these ships ended up shooting each other down. They were fighting when they got here, and they both crashed. And the government found one, and the second one isn't found until present day, and that's the name, the second ship.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens in brief is these kids, being who they are, they know they should turn this thing over to the government. It's an important find. But they also know if they do that, they'll never get a chance to take a look at the thing. Yeah, so they decide to take a peek inside, and they can actually get into this thing because it's got a hole punched through it from the weapon of the other ship.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when they get up in there, they find out. They end up trying on messing around with some equipment they shouldn't mess around with, and they end up activating a link between the shipboard computer systems and these headsets they've put on,
okay.
And it forms a direct tie-in to their brain, and ends up putting them in a situation where they feel like that the ship that the government has technologies on it that should not, definitely should not be released to the public. And because of that, they're in a bad situation. You know, they can't report it to the government. They're only juniors in high school. They can't really tell their parents about it. They work at the laboratory. They'll lose their clearance or it'll be turned over. So they know they're in completely over their heads. And so they are scrambling, trying to find a way to deal with this situation. And the plan they come up with gets them in even more trouble, which is they decide to drop an anonymous message to the NSA that something is wrong with the research being done inside the Rogue Project. So anyway, this whole thing just spins out of their control, and it ends up being a situation where these nice, comfortable lives they've got at the beginning of the story just get put through the meat grinder in this series.
Right. And, of course, you've got the government trying to figure out what they know, what they don't know.
Well, right. And you know, when the NSA, the message these kids send is, and they do it in a very sophisticated way. They drop a message on an anonymous network, and it's directed to the NSA. It's encrypted. They know the NSA can break it. They just hope the NSA breaks it before anybody else breaks it. But essentially, that message says or implies that one of the scientists on the Rogue Project, which is the government project studying this alien craft, has sent the message, and that he is saying there is something seriously wrong with that project. Well, when the NSA gets this, they spin up a team. And since 9/11, of course, all the rules have changed on what the NSA can and cannot do. Anyway, they spin up this team of special operatives that come into Los Alamos, and they're doing two things. They're, number one, they're trying to find out who really sent this message. And number two, they're also looking at the possibility there might really be something wrong inside the Rogue Project. So they come in without alerting other agencies or anything like that, and they start to examine the situation.
Now, they're not aware that there is a second ship yet.
Oh, no. They definitely don't know anything about that. And these young people don't want them to find out who they were, that they sent the message. Also, one other factor that comes into play with this, it turns out that when that computer established a link to these young people's minds, it didn't alter their DNA or anything like that. It just made their internal connections better. You know, they say, you know, there's a common saying that we use 10% of our brains. Well, suddenly these young people find themselves able to perform better than that with their brains. But that causes them a ton of difficulties. So anyway, this thing just spins out of control, and when the government starts to figure out that somebody is snooping around, the typical government response of crackdown and cover-up takes effect.
Right. Sounds like a fascinating story, and from what I've read about it so far, I tell you, you've definitely got my attention on this. When I first went into this, to be honest with you, Richard, I wasn't quite sure like where I was going to end up, if there was going to be anything there that would really catch my attention. But you tangled the web, and it's a story that not only does it have the opportunity of a great deal of offshoots, the story is so plausible. You gotta look at it and think,
well,
wow.
It was funny. I was on when I was on Coast to Coast AM the other night. Ian Punnett was trying to hammer me on that particular part. And it's definitely true. There is quite a bit of actual factual science in the second ship. And with my background, everything from West Point Army Ranger, and then having worked at the National Laboratories on a bunch of highly classified programs, you know, the natural thing that comes into people's minds is, you know, did I cross the line anywhere in putting classified stuff into the second ship? Well, I was really careful not to do that. But at the same time, What I did want to do is I wanted to give people a little bit of a peek at the kind of technologies that are being investigated right now, without getting specific on actual classified programs. I kind of leave that to people's imagination as to where what I'm talking about brushes up against reality or not.
Right, right. And I think I think you've done a good job. Now, we'll never know which parts of the book are a full target hit, if you will. I can see where Ian was going on Coast to Coast, trying to nudge you into secret technologies. And if he hadn't have tried it Friday night, Saturday morning, Richard, I would have tried it myself tonight. But I heard the response with Ian, so I do know exactly how you sound. And let's face it, you have a little document called the Official Secrets Act that could make you disappear for a very long time.
This general rule of thumb, which is not to go to prison. One of the things I think is going to be, everybody's always asking, how long can the government keep something like this bottled up? And I know Grant spent a long time talking about that last hour. But I will say that, you have to ask yourself the question, anytime you're talking about why would aliens come here, why wouldn't they just reveal themselves to everybody, okay? And the only thing I think makes sense is that they're waiting for us to achieve a certain point in our own technological development where we meet a certain criteria. And one of the things I'm seeing is whether they're helping us or not, without getting into that, our technology, our advancement in technology is speeding up, and it's getting ready to speed up tremendously with this. The second computers actually start thinking for themselves, which is not far away. We're getting incredibly close with pattern recognition stuff and computers learning to recognize things. It's only a few steps farther before they acquire the capacity to pick what they want to learn. Mm-hmm. And as soon as that happens, the rate of advancement and potentially dangerous side effects are going to go right through the roof, because when they're designing the next generation of computer, they're not limited to an evolutionary. They have essentially unlimited resources because of the way computers can network. So we are getting close to something that is potentially very, very exciting, and also we better think long and hard about.
Right. John Hogue, in the last promo that we did when we went to the break there, he has a saying there that the next series of events is about knowing. Now, we're changing into the age of Aquarius, where no longer is it about thinking we know. We're going to know one way.
I think that's within 7 or 8 years at the latest. If the advancements in neural networking and pattern recognition continue to grow faster and faster like they are right now, we're about 2 computer cycles, which would be about 4 years, okay, away from the first first actual learning machine. And then it would typically take another 2 cycles after that for the first iteration of machines starting to be to participate in their own design type of thing. Yeah. So
you look back again. We look back on technology. You and I are about the same age. I was born in 56. And the first computer that I was ever trained on was as big as a 1,500-square-foot home, and it spewed out punch cards at the other end. After hours of computing, it would spew out a digit card, and
right.
we would have to declassify and decode the digit card, and it was no better than the average calculator that a kid takes to school.
Oh, right. The iPhones are far superior to anything that was done back in those days.
Yeah. Yeah. They say that the computers that we have in our houses, our domestic computers, are more powerful than the original computer that took man to the moon.
And this whole notion of massively parallel systems. Well, one thing, and I won't wreck the series, but one thing that I'm working on right now in the final book of the Row Agenda series which is titled Wormhole, is this notion that the government has infected every computer, practically every computer on the planet. And the way they did it was back in the 80s and 90s, they encouraged hackers to start creating virus programs. And the response was everybody needed antivirus software. And antivirus software, everybody has to have it on their machine. And so within the story of Wormhole, the government has essentially had a secret program to insert a kernel into all of these antivirus companies' software so that everybody has this kernel on their machine. And guess what antivirus software does? It watches every bit of information on your machine, reads every one of your files, reads every bit of Internet traffic coming in and out, guarding against viruses, and would be the absolute perfect place to scan everybody's data for anything.
And
they could report back during normal, you can have that easily reporting back in during updates or during, or just during network monitoring. So, so anyway, that's just some people have to think about what is on their systems, and it may be something that they think is making their system safe.
Right. When in effect, it's a gateway allowing governments to snoop on their very private surfing, if you will, or even their personal financial documents on their computers.
Absolutely.
And that's a scary consequence of how much freedom do we give up. There's a big argument right now regarding the Internet of whether the White House or the government of the day should have the presidential power to take over control of networks during an emergency. And there's a big stink about the freedom of the Internet. And wouldn't it be ironic if the government's already there and we just didn't know it?
I would say that it would be ironic, but it's something people need to think about.
Well, if we think about it, it's possible. That's where I...
Well, you can guarantee it's possible. And yeah. If it's possible, there's probably people out there doing it.
Right. So we've made it to the number one bestseller upon I believe it's Amazon that gave you the number one spot this last week on the second ship. That's an incredible move through the Amazon system.
Right, and it shuffles around in the top five.
Right.
They're updating all the time. But I'm very pleased about that, and we've had very good responses from all those people that have read it. And one of the things I do is I can't always respond to everybody's emails, but I do read everybody's emails, and that's quite a task. But I have my email address up on my website, and it's richardphillips@secondship.net, and my website's secondship.com.
Secondship.com. And I've been up there, and I was scooting around there today, and I got to tell you, there's a whole bunch of really good information up there and good links that people will enjoy. I have to put a plug in for your wife, Richard. Married 28 years. This lady must be a saint. Yeah, he must be an absolute saint. 28 years, that's in human terms, that's almost ancient. There are not many here.
She's quite a doll. She owns a restaurant here in Tempe, and it's called Easy Bread Co. Cafe. And she's a people person. I mean, I tend to be more on the technical side and like to get hunkered down with my computers or writing a book. And I have to kind of step out of my shell a little more to talk to folks. But she's a natural. She just talks to everybody.
Yeah, well, obviously a good balance. 28 years, my friend. I mean, that's, you guys have got to be doing something, right?
Yeah, that's, I think we are.
Now, on when you were on Coast to Coast the other night, you had mentioned that scientists would soon be able to engineer organic cellular machines.
Well, this is one of the things I talk about heavily in the second ship. But essentially, this deals with nanotechnology and specifically medical nanotechnology. But I go at it from a little different way. The actual designing these tiny machines, and they've been able to do these atomic machines or molecular machines that have little propellers. You've probably seen some of that on the internet and stuff. But that's not going to be the breakthrough. The real breakthrough is going to come in an area, and now you've got to remember this is my take on things. But my belief is the real breakthrough that we're getting close to is going to come with this linkage of kind of a reverse linkage. In the past, it's always been cybernetic organisms. But I think it's going to be more on the biological side that's augmented or directed by tiny chip machines, or you can think of them as micro transistors that influence that provide just a little extra guidance, a little extra ability to our own systems. Just the simple ability to read a strand of DNA and to direct bodily systems to try to repair that type of thing. Not little machines scurrying all the way around through your body, but guiding some of your own cells to do the same type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one area of research I think that is going to have some huge breakthroughs in the relatively near term.
Right. The nanotechnology fascinates me. I think it's absolutely brilliant, and I think we're just on the edge of it. I think it may be the savior of the future for a lot of medical procedures.
Well, and it also has some significant downside risks to it. So it's got to be it's got to be very carefully thought through and managed.
Well, because you're basically releasing almost a man-made virus, if you will. Even though it's nanotechnology, it's
well. That's a very good analogy. I mean, that's exactly at least that's a very good approximation of what you're doing.
And how would you control it once it's released?
Well, this gets back to the point of computers acquiring the ability to learn on their own. The way that happens is not the way we think. One of the things I mentioned the other night was computers are surprising us. They tend to think in very alien ways, and I don't necessarily mean that as extraterrestrial ways. I mean the way they recognize patterns is with a bunch of little neurons or tiny processors, each receiving a wide variety of input and making a little decision to do something a certain way. So they're monitored by a different net, and what that does is that causes them to be rewarded when they make a correct decision and they become stronger through that particular node. It's a weird way of thinking. The way I'd categorize it is, you remember like the old Frankenstein movies where they had these two big lightning balls and there'd be an occasional arc of lightning back and forth between them. That's the way computers were. But the way the computers operate now is like with one of these these plasma balls that you see at curio shops or whatever, with, you know, thousands and thousands of little tiny threads of electricity crawling all along the inside surface. And if you touch that thing with your finger, all at once it attracts the attention of a whole host of these things. They tend to congregate. They swarm toward this disturbance that your finger has caused, almost as if they're examining it. And that's the way computers think. I mean, they swarm these massively parallel systems, form kind of a swarm computing algorithm, and they make judgments on their own, independent of whatever the programmers aren't telling them specifically what to do anymore. So that's kind of how computers are evolving into these swarm of little, not very powerful things, but when you put the swarm together, they can do amazingly powerful things.
And this swarm mentality, like you say, it's on their own, they're almost inert. But when they start joining together and having a joint understanding of their mission.
That's exactly right. The intent kind of gets propagated, and the goal of the scientists, of course, is to be able to give these things a good intent that they all kind of share among themselves, and pretty soon the swarm of them are doing a bunch of simple things that together is a very powerful thing, and it ends up being what you wanted it to do. Now, the danger is if they start to get a little bit off on their intent, that they start to do something very powerful that wasn't exactly what you intended.
Right. Right. And as you say, with computers starting to build themselves and repair and create, would the nanotechnology do the same and make an attempt to improve the host that they're in?
Yeah, well, that is a big topic within the second ship in the Row Agenda series. What would that lead to?
And how would you control it? It's, you know, once you open the floodgates, the control could be the end of mankind if it's not, if the technology...
Or even if it's good. Let's imagine, I mean, the kind of a simpler case... Rosie on the Jetsons, you know, the robot that cleaned the house, and they would just say, oh, go to the store and get groceries, whatever. Robots like that are not that far off. And then is anybody going to work? I mean, if you could have a Rosie, why would companies hire workers? And if the workers could have one at their house, which everybody would want an appliance like that, pretty soon, everybody doesn't have anything to do, but productivity is through the roof. So what does that do to our society? I mean, do we have just a bunch of lazy people laying around being taken care of by robots? Or, you know, there's lots of things to be concerned about in that whole scenario.
Yeah, society is based on work. I mean, if you didn't have to work, and you were taken care of by the system, so to speak, what kind of a society would we become if there was no more rat race, if there was no more ladder climbing, except for getting the better robot, I guess.
It's a significant concern. I mean, it sounds attractive, and it may be attractive, but I mean, at that point, somebody has got to take care of it. I mean, the system, or let's say, that would mandate some sort of socialist system. And then where do individual freedoms go? I mean,
And privacy?
Well, privacy is pretty well gone now. I hate to tell people this, but it pretty much is. You know, anything you do on a computer is monitored by someone. And starting right on your own system with stuff you installed on it and called your antivirus software. And everything you do that touches the internet is monitored for sure. And all that data is mined and sorted and not just by the government, but obviously by corporations as well.
Absolutely. Richard, I can't believe it, but we're at the top of the hour already. Boy, has this 2 hours gone awfully fast tonight for some reason. It's been a pleasure, sir. We're going to have you back when Wormhole is released, right after Second Ship. Am I correct?
Well, Second Ship is out in paperback. Immune is getting ready to come out in paperback. It's completely done, and actually people can get a pre-published galley-proof print-on-demand version before it's released. But I'm working hard on Wormhole now, so that'll be the next one that I come out with.
Fabulous. Richard, it's been an absolute pleasure, sir. Thank Carol for giving us the time tonight. Do appreciate it, sir.
Well, and thank you for being flexible with me after I was delayed getting here.
Yeah, at least we got you to the air, and that's what counts. Sir, it's been an absolute pleasure.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure for me as well.
Take care, sir, and we will talk to you again. Ladies and gentlemen, Richard Phillips, author of The Second Ship. Fabulous book. You've got to check it out. We got to get out of here. 2 hours. Can't believe it's been so soon.
Look to the heavens after some form of divine inspiration so I can feed the masses I can. The dead well with them. So what I would like to say to you tonight is, if you have friends, embrace them. If you have loved ones, cherish them. If you have acquaintances, respect them. And if you have love, show them. God bless you all.